Yoling fain a go
And I'm going to take the next 40 minutes or so to explore intersubjectivity in a series of interviews I conducted with first-generation Irish immigrants in Winnipeg, Manitoba. Before I get started, I should mention that this podcast accompanies my article for the Oral History Forum entitled Speaking of the Sacred, Exploring Religion, Spirituality, and the Boundaries of Emotional Communities Through Oral History. Some of the content will overlap, but I'm using this space to talk more about my methodology and to make some of the interview excerpts available for others to hear. For more context and a deeper discussion of my argument, I would recommend checking out the article on the Oral History Forum website. Now, on to intersubjectivity. What exactly does this word mean? Lynn Abrams has written one of the go-to books on oral history theory and methodology, and she describes intersubjectivity in this way. Intersubjectivity, in the context of oral history, refers to the relationship between the interviewee and interviewer, or, in other words, the interpersonal dynamics of the interview situation and the process by which the participants cooperate to create a shared narrative. So, it's about the relationship between the people involved in the interview and how that relationship shapes the stories that are told. This is something oral historians have found a little tricky. Unlike most text-based historical documents like newspapers, letters, and so on, oral historians are typically involved in the creation of our own primary sources. So how do we deal with our own presence and agenda in the interview when we start our analysis? When people share stories, more often than not, they naturally shape the story to suit the context and the audience. So when I tell my mom a story about my day over coffee, it will be different from the way I tell an acquaintance or a coworker in a more formal situation. In an interview, interviewees respond to our questions, comments, body language, and while the core of their story most likely won't change, the way they tell it will. We shape the interview simply by being present. On that note, the project itself will have a significant effect on the content of our interviews. For example, my interviews were conducted as a part of my master's thesis project for the history department at Carleton University. After recruiting interviewees, I gave them an official letter that described the project, and I introduced it to them as an exploration of their migration experience. Framing the interview in this way meant that most of our conversations were naturally related to migration. This included memories of Ireland, dealing with Irish history among Winnipeg's Irish Canadians, the role of music and performance in connecting to a sense of Irish identity, and feeling in and out of place. So as we move into the analysis stage of our research, oral historians have to consider these kinds of forces which will shape our interviews. Some oral historians have sought to address this by asking interviewees to tell their life story and remain silent until the interviewee feels they've finished. Then the interviewer enters the conversation more fully by asking questions and making comments. There are definite benefits to this way of interviewing. For example, interviewers are not going to interrupt interviewees' train of thought or accidentally cut a story short. While the stories interviewees choose to include in their broader life narrative will change from day to day, the exercise of thinking through their life and condensing it into a series of stories often results in a rich and fascinating interview which could be used for any number of varying projects. But it's worth noting that whether or not the interviewer speaks, they are still part of the conversation. Oral historians who use this methodology recognize that limiting their voice in this first part of the interview does not remove intersubjectivity. I considered this methodology when I was making plans for my interviews, but I eventually decided to take a slightly more structured approach. Conducting interviews in this way can be pretty time-consuming and usually requires many sittings. In addition, this methodology encourages providing interviewees with a transcript after the interview so that they can review it and edit their stories if they choose. This adds to the amount of time needed for this process, and because of the time constraints of my program and the busy schedules of my interviewees, it wasn't really an option. My interviews were structured more like conversations from the start. I was particularly influenced by scholars like Alessandro Portelli, who emphasizes that interviews are co-created by participants. In an essay about methodology, Portelli writes, "An interview is an exchange between two subjects, literally a mutual sighting. One party cannot really see the other unless the other can see him or her in turn. The two interacting subjects cannot act together unless some kind of mutuality is established. What appealed to me about the conversational approach was that it gave my interviews a considerable amount of flexibility. I could ask the questions that related to my research, but we could also linger on topics interviewees felt were important. It also gave interviewees the opportunity to flip things around and ask me some questions if they wished, establishing that mutuality that Portelli describes. These interviews are perhaps more narrow in their scope compared to those that come out of the life story approach, and there are times when I look back and I wish that I had stayed quiet a little longer. But this style is common among academics working with time constraints, and these interviews are still rich sources. I particularly like the moments in which the exchange between myself and my interviewees opened up opportunities to speak of stories that may not have been shared otherwise. And it's these moments that I'd like to examine further in this podcast. Take my conversation with Maureen Taggart, whose voice you would have heard singing at the beginning of this podcast. I quickly felt a connection with Maureen, and we were soon chatting comfortably about her memories of Ireland and her identity as Irish in Canada. There was even a point at the end of our first interview where Maureen asked about my people, and I told her about my grandparents, particularly my Oma's experience during World War II. In our next sitting, I asked Maureen to tell me more about her grandfather, who had died when she was 7, and whom she described as being a very influential figure in her life. It was as if memories of him were just pouring out of her in these beautiful stories she shared, and at one point she paused and mentioned she hadn't spoken about this in ages. Here's a clip from the story about his passing.
And I had a feeling he was dying. But even at that age, I knew, you know, that we were raised with births, deaths, and marriages. When yeah. babies were born, we were all taken to see the new baby. Mm-hmm. And even though we thought it came in the doctor's bag,
not sure how it ended up there. But
yeah, that's yeah. yes. And we always attended what we called corpse houses, mm. where you know the dead person would be laid out on the bed, and yeah. we would be just taken there, and we'd yeah. pray, and we'd sit there and talk. And
it's a very different, I don't know, attitude towards that sort of death and dying and that sort of thing. I like reading about how people would. Like families would take care of the bodies after.
Oh yes.
After people died, and we never do that now. Like no. we don't. It's no. very removed in oh. ways.
Well, my grandfather, when he died, I know my grandmother took care of that, mm-hmm. and I also remember an old friend of his came by. And my grandmother was airing his shirt mm-hmm. in front of the fire. Mm. And to put on him before the shroud was put on, yeah. you know. So, yes, people did. They did all of that. Yeah.
I find that moment in which she describes her grandmother airing her grandfather's shirt in front of the fire before arranging his shroud to be an incredibly moving image, and I'm not sure Maureen would have thought to share this if the conversation hadn't flowed the way it did. While our presence in the interview may complicate things, creating a space for conversation and participating in the dialogue can have its benefits. Understanding intersubjectivity and my place in the interview process is important in developing the argument I make in the accompanying article, Speaking of the Sacred. In the paper, I use Barbara H. Rosenwein's theoretical framework of emotional communities. Basically, she argues that there are different emotional groups with rules about what emotions are appropriate in certain social situations and how emotions should be properly displayed. For example, at a protest, you're typically expected to feel and communicate anger in a certain way that would be significantly different from how you would express anger or frustration within a work setting. Rosenwein suggests that emotional communities sometimes overlap, so that the smaller emotional community of an Irish ethnic association in Winnipeg would fit within the wider emotional communities of Canadian society and the Irish diaspora. In the article, I compare stories about religion and spirituality in the interviews I conducted. I examine what meaning these stories most convey to me and look at when interviewees seemed most comfortable to talk about their spiritual experiences. I argue that by doing so, we can begin to see the boundaries that certain emotional communities have concerning conversations about faith or experiences of the sublime. Along with the broader emotional communities of Canadian and Manitoban society, the Irish diaspora, and Winnipeg's Irish community, I suggest that a small emotional community is created between myself and my interviewees. It is this emotional community that I want to focus on for the remainder of this podcast, because it's the one that's most affected by my methodology. It's shaped by the boundaries of the project that I established before our interviews and the intersubjectivity within our conversations. To begin with, the questions I asked focus mostly on migration and Irish collective memory and weren't aimed to create an exchange about religion or spirituality. Yet these subjects came up relatively often in particular contexts. Those familiar with Irish history will know that religion in Ireland has been deeply connected with politics, largely due to centuries of British colonial practices. The history of independence in the south and sectarian conflict in the north, known as the Troubles, continues to shape perspectives of religion and culture in the minds of many. A clip from my conversation with Joe and Mary Campbell, a couple I interviewed together, illustrates this connection.
So then, when you would sing these songs, were they always in English or were they ever...
Oh, English, yeah. No, we would sing in English, yeah.
There are some songs we'd still... I have a record here, Irish stuff, and we'd, she and I would sing, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, Rose, say the Baha,
well, yeah, up by the mines and down by Dala.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, this top, chocolate style. Yeah. So,
yeah.
And we did learn a lot of Irish rebel, a kind of rebel, patriotic songs.
Right. Yeah.
With the brothers. The Christian brothers were very, very, very. Yeah, I mean that's how really Gaelic football and hurling started, the big, the huge, to as opposition to the Protestant soccer.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? It's interesting.
Yeah.
But soccer was seen as English, not so much Protestant, but English, and we don't want anything English.
Yeah.
So,
well, that's,
so
that started in the early 1900s.
Oh yeah, that
when there was
way
that
back.
Huge cultural revival, which always precedes revolution, doesn't it? That cultural.
That's right.
Identity awareness and what I know from the 1900s onwards, like Yeats and the Abbey Theatre, and then there was Douglas Hyde and the Gaelic League, isn't that another one, Joe? The GAA started then.
The Gaelic Athletic Association.
Used to call it the Grab All Association.
Nationalism and religion are deeply intertwined in Irish collective memory and have had a significant influence on the ways in which traditional cultural activities were, and still are, understood. In all but a few select cases, conversations about religion usually conveyed more to me about how they've figured out how to deal with these sectarian divisions that loom so large in Irish collective memory now that they've settled in Manitoba. Tom Naughton's interview speaks well to this trend, so let's turn to some of his stories. Tom was raised Catholic in Dublin, and his wife Heather, whose father is a retired minister and dean in the Anglican Church, was born in Belfast. The couple met in Winnipeg through the Manitoba Irish Association, and in this clip, Tom describes the early stages of their relationship.
And so we ended up in Osborne Village, in a Greek restaurant there, and... just as we're about to have dessert, she jumps, oh, I have to go, goodbye, I'm gone.
Yeah.
So where are you going? She says, oh, I have to go to the folk mass at St. Luke's. And I had no idea what that was. But anyway, she headed off. And so a week later, I get to have dinner with her again. And I said, okay, you're not running out on me again this time. You know, where are you going? We'll have to go to the folk mass. Okay, well, I'm coming too.
Yeah.
So we go to St. Luke's Church, and there's a folk mass on there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's Anglican. It's not Catholic, it's Anglican. And I'm going, wait a minute, this is a Protestant church.
Yeah.
She said, yeah. Okay, well, whatever, sure. Okay, so I go in. I knew all the prayers. I knew all the liturgy. It wasn't different.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going, these people are normal looking people.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they're Protestants.
Yeah.
But they're normal. This is weird.
Yeah. Was that sort of the first time you had... I guess run into something like that? Or?
It's the first Protestant service I'd gone to.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew people from both sides,
mm-hmm.
In Ireland, and that was fine.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to a Catholic school, and a cousin of mine who was Protestant from
mm-hmm.
up north, he came and stayed with us, and I would drag him off to church on Sunday and Mass,
yeah.
right? And he said, years later I talked to him about it, and he said, I had no idea what was going on. He said, I just got up when you got up, and I got knelt down when you knelt down, and that was fine, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But to him, it was a big opening of eyes, and mine was a big opening of eyes when I went to St. Luke's. It probably wasn't the very, no, it must have been the first service I went to, because I really didn't know. And the church looked Protestant. It's different than a Catholic
yeah.
church. It's got flags and things up, you know. But it wasn't alien,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't really different. And
mm-hmm.
what they were talking about and what they were preaching on and what they were saying and the prayers they were doing were all very, very comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't been in church in a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
I really hadn't. Since I'd left Ireland, I hadn't really been involved with church at all.
Mm-hmm.
So it felt very good to be back in a church and,
mm-hmm.
and to have some contact again.
A little later, Tom described meeting his in-laws and delved deeper into how he, Heather, and their family have found ways to compromise and work around the memory of Irish sectarian conflict.
You know, and so Heather and I, in our years of being married and having kids and the kids and others, have looked at many of the incentives to come back to Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're usually about is you bring your network back and you use your connections with Canada in business or something like that to try and help Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And so we talked about it many times, but it always came back to the same thing. We had two young sons who were in school. Whether they were in junior school, high school, or whatever. They were in school.
Mm-hmm.
What school were we going to put them in when we went back to Ireland?
Yeah.
Protestant school or the Catholic school?
Yeah.
Which church were we going to go to on Sunday? The Catholic school or the Catholic church or the Protestant church?
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't want to answer the question.
Mm-hmm.
So here in Winnipeg, we're going to an Anglican church
mm-hmm.
that I felt incredibly comfortable with and not alien at all. The boys went to schools down the road, local schools that
mm-hmm.
weren't religious.
Mm-hmm.
We went to an Irish club. And we hung out and met a lot of other Irish people where there were no flags, no
mm-hmm.
Irish flags or any flags flown.
Yeah.
They're only the four flags of the provinces are flown.
Mm-hmm.
So it's non-political, non-sectarian.
Mm-hmm.
And we work very, very hard to do that. Because when you have an AGM, you'll have 20, 25 families represented. And of those 25 families, maybe 20 of them, 23 of them, are Protestant Catholic mixed marriages.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't have it where a husband and wife go into the club and there's one flag.
Mm-hmm.
Well, who's going to feel left out?
Yeah.
You can't do it.
Yeah.
So, you know, my talk with Ralph was very important
because
mm-hmm. he didn't want those issues
mm-hmm.
of religion and politics and all that's coming into his daughter's life
mm-hmm.
again, if he could help it.
While Tom's religious beliefs and practices are part of this story, to me, these narratives show more about how they managed Irish collective memory in their family and the importance of finding shared spaces in which they can all be comfortable. It is interesting to compare these kinds of narratives to the ways interviewees tended to speak about landscape and environment. Unlike the conversations we had about religion, these narratives were full of spiritual language and often described feelings of something sublime or transcendent. Here's Tom again, telling me how he feels connected to the land in Ireland.
Well, I wanted to ask you too, because, I mean, geography and everything and space, and I was curious about what you had to say about space and heritage and like land and heritage. Do you feel that they're connected?
Oh God, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, let me put it a weird way to you. I can never get the Ireland out of me
mm-hmm.
because there's too many ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
The spirit of the land.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I go walk in Ireland, there's a spirit you can feel. It's ancient. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's you know, you turn any corner in Ireland and you're coming up against a bunch of vertical stones or something that, you know, yeah, have been part of something for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Stonehenge, you know. Mm-hmm. You find Stonehenge everywhere. Stonehenge is just a nice big one. But there's tons of them around,
yeah,
all over. Because, you know, the Celts before in Ireland did, they were in touch with the land a lot. And we are. We all grow out of the land. I suspect Mennonites do the same thing, but a lot of Canadians don't, because Canadians are mobile.
Yeah.
It's a lot more mobility. Even given the fact that here you'll find a lot of people who urban people, who are living three doors down from the house that they grew up in when their mother owned it, you know? You'll get a lot of that happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
People go away, but they come back.
Yeah.
And so there is a cot to the land a bit that way, but it's like cot to the city, not cot to the land.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas a farming community is stuck to the land, mm-hmm, you know, they walk it, they get so much growth out of it, they feel it. There's a spirit yeah, connectivity. It's the same thing in Ireland. And what's funny is, I can give you tons of stories of ghosts, that ghost stories that my father taught me, but also ghost stories that I felt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, camping and things I can't explain, but feelings of spirits and places I've been. And I could go back and feel them again now. I tell you exactly where they are.
Yeah.
And there's spirits and there's feelings and there's ancient feelings. And I've only ever once felt a spirit in Canada.
Oh, really?
And that was up in the Yukon. When I was way the way the hell and gone from everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only time I've ever felt it. And I'd been there for a couple of days. And I was pretty much in tune with the land at that time. But I've never felt it, that same spirit in Canada. And I don't know whether it's me,
mm-hmm,
and this is an alien Canada.
Yeah.
An alien land that I haven't grown up with.
Mm-hmm.
Or what?
Just as a quick side note, there are so many moments in these interviews that I absolutely love, and this clip with Tom is one of my favorites. It evokes such vivid imagery about human relationships to land and environment. Tom was not the only one to speak of Ireland in this way. Brian Richardson also used similar language in describing his connection to Ireland and Canada.
So then what was it like to be back in Ireland for that time? There's also all this other stuff going on.
Yeah, well, it took a lot. I was, there's parts of the Irish culture I'm not ever going to be comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's the way it is. And probably that's true of a lot of people in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot that was just second nature. Whether or not I liked it, I could understand it as second nature.
Yeah.
It's there.
Yeah.
But I also recognize that I had lived in Canada for more of my life than I did in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever created my original spirit is still there.
Mm-hmm.
It's been changed and affected by being here.
Mm-hmm.
But and I always talk about it as the difference between soul and maybe even soul and spirit. I'm not quite sure which, but mm-hmm, it's the soul is created there, the spirit is what carries on.
Right.
And learning to find where to balance the two.
Mm-hmm.
I loved being in Ireland.
Yeah.
I love being there. I love being back in the green and the mild and meeting people that I was starting to click with.
When I listen to these narratives, I have a sense that Brian and Tom are describing an experience that is, in many ways, indescribable. It's that feeling of being connected and belonging to a certain space, a space that they are now separated from through migration. While I have never moved to another country, I feel I was able to grasp some of their meaning because, in my own experience, I have felt a kind of spiritual connection to the prairies. I feel like I belong in this space, and this kind of bond is most evident to me when I am living elsewhere. These kinds of descriptions about land and environment are familiar and comfortable in the context of our Western secularized society, especially considering the growing religious tones of the environmental movement. The emotional community of Canadian society in general allows for spiritual language in stories about nature. I would argue that this kind of established rhetoric opens up doors for interviewees to speak freely about this aspect of their migration experience. I develop this argument more in my paper, so if you'd like to dig into it a little deeper, I would again recommend that you check out the article if you haven't already. But for now, I'd like to move on to look at two examples of those rare moments when interviewees spoke openly about their beliefs and the evolution of their personal theology. And it's here where I'm going to bring it back to intersubjectivity and the boundaries of our small emotional community in the interview setting. Let's start with Brian. This clip comes out of a conversation about the breadth of his coursework at university while studying biology in Potsdam, New York.
Well, it did give me, one of the things about the science, and I often go into very generalized things from stuff, but I got a sense of the immensity of the universe and the immensity of the micro universe.
Mm-hmm.
I think for the first time it really came home to me when we got to use an electron microscope, and I went, yike.
Yeah.
And look how deep we're seeing, and we're just scratching the surface. And then, you know, getting some idea of atomic theory, getting all of this material,
mm-hmm.
and then starting to look out into the stars and really coming to see how incredibly vast.
Yeah.
It changes your theology too.
It does.
I kind of gave up on all of the church in my second year.
And was that something that sort of lasted the rest of your life then, or was it a...
Yeah, I think I'm reformulating what I see. The idea of a God who's sitting down looking at us and, you know, waving the finger and so forth,
mm-hmm.
That really disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
I do see a great force. I don't see one necessarily that's sitting watching us.
Right.
What I came to, and I really haven't read enough of him, but I've read about his theory, is Spinoza.
Oh, I've heard of
him. Spinoza was a very interesting character, 1600s. He was a Dutch Jew. They went to Holland because they were least persecuted in Holland.
Right.
He started talking about seeing God. He had some real problems with religion. He said, you know, at the bottom, yes, it starts out well, but then it becomes a controlling element. That, in fact, he saw all nature as God.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that makes sense, you know, that it is. It's everything. And whether there's an entity that encompasses that,
yeah,
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that I encountered was the Gaia theory. Now, to some degree, I had already been starting to arrive at the idea that the planet itself is a living organism.
Mm-hmm.
What the Gaia theory has really started to do is prove it scientifically.
Mm-hmm.
But that living organism must also have a consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
More than likely. Which means that every element, if Earth has a consciousness, Mars has a consciousness, the Sun has a consciousness... And that's where my theology is going. What is that consciousness?
Right.
That each one is one step next to.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, and now I'm having to come back and look at my behavior and say, okay, did I have an ethics? Yeah, I did, but did I follow all of it? No.
Mm-hmm.
Now I have to re-examine that and try to set myself up in that direction.
Right.
I may be coming to it late, but I'm coming to it.
Yeah, yeah. Winding journey.
Mm-hmm. Long and winding road, yeah. As the Beatles sang.
Yeah.
In my paper, I argue that this moment is significant because, unlike the other conversations discussed earlier, it's not really about his migration experience. Instead, it's just about the evolution of his personal beliefs. I suggest that part of the reason Brian was one of the few to speak so openly on this topic is because his beliefs fit relatively comfortably into discourses about the environment that have become quite prominent in the secular West. But I think it's also important to note that in this clip, I helped prompt this discussion by asking him a question. I interviewed Brian a little later in the research process, and at this point, I was starting to become interested in finding out more about the personal beliefs of my interviewees. So, when the opportunity seemed to present itself, I started to ask them to tell me more. I would argue that this question is important because it helped establish that, within the emotional community of our interview, conversations about personal theology were welcomed. I think this comes through a little more in my conversation with Katrina Younger. I didn't include her in the paper, but I feel this clip fits well with an exploration of my methodology. We had been chatting about the stories of St. Patrick and Irish folklore that she had heard from her mother or grandmother or pop culture. This includes a Disney movie called Darby O'Gill and the Little People, which had frightened her as a child and which she mentions briefly in this clip. I decided that it was a good moment to ask a question that I had been curious about, but hadn't really asked anyone else.
How does the sort of faith connect with the I guess, ethnic heritage? Yeah. Does that have a connection, or is it sort of separate realms?
Well, I think it has it because, you know, in Ireland, they go to church regularly. We do too, but they seem to have, I would call, a closer connection. Mm. Like my mother, when she got in the car, we said the rosary right away. If we were going on a trip, we said the rosary along the way.
Yeah.
And that was the first thing we did when we got in the car.
Yeah.
And so like that takes a bit of time. So we would all be answering and whatever. It was, it was a bit of a commitment. And, yeah, we just always did that if we were going for a trip, like, say, to Falcon Lake or something.
Yeah.
Then we would get in the car, we'd say the rosary, and we'd move on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was her way of calling on God to help. She used to say the morning offering, which is another prayer of the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that she always said that every morning because she couldn't look after us. So mm-hmm. basically you were calling on God to help you through the day and mm-hmm. to keep everyone safe.
Yeah.
And so she, I think, had more of a living faith than maybe I do. I'd like to have that, but I don't have it.
Right.
But she, everything was about God and serving God and asking God for help.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a real strong, living everyday faith. Now, part of that, in my view, is because the church was so rigid at that time. And so everything was, you know, clearly defined as to what was a sin and what was not a sin and what levels of sin and how you had to go to confession
yeah.
and all of that stuff. Because I remember when I went to school even, you know, just sort of being horrified at what terrible things I had done and that I had to run to confession the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be things like, I just remember opening, now I can't remember the name of the church, but there's a church on Grosvenor at Wilton.
Mm.
It's quite a, I've been in there for Michael when he was with the Winnipeg Boys Choir, but
right.
when I was 6 years old, I opened that door because, you know, non-Catholics and churches were bad. You weren't supposed to ever go into a church
right.
that was not of your faith,
really?
Catholic only. Yeah, you weren't allowed to be a bridesmaid, you weren't allowed to be, you know, they were not... Mm. the saved. And that's the message that I got as
yeah,
a child.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, not it's my child message, right? It's not necessarily the real message,
mm-hmm.
but that's the message I got. I went to Catholic schools, and my friends who were non-Catholic also went to some of the private Catholic schools that I went to.
Mm-hmm.
And they sat at the back during Bible study, but they could not, during religion class, but they could not ask questions or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I started to really question a little bit
mm-hmm.
what I was hearing, because it was like they were not ever going to get to heaven, but we were going to get to heaven because we knew the true way and whatever. And I just thought, yeah, like I don't know about
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
So, and my brother Jim was also, you know, sort of prodding me a little bit to ask questions because
yeah.
everything was so black and white. And there really isn't black and white in real life. You
mm-hmm.
know, it's more of gray and
yeah.
and you know, maybe some white, maybe some black.
Yeah.
But generally
mostly different shades of
yeah,
gray.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
We're all in shades of gray.
Yeah.
So, I mean, all of that might have also had an impact on why she led her life the way she did.
Right.
It may have been out of faith. It may have been out of, you know, this is the only way to do it, and this is the way we need to do it. You know, the Mass was in Latin. Mm-hmm. We said all our prayers, our own prayers in English, but at church everything was in Latin, yeah. So we all learned to speak Latin. Wow. and say all the prayers in Latin.
Yeah.
And it had a ceremony to it, you know. Like when we got up in the morning, we'd go to church first thing in the morning because we weren't allowed to eat before you had communion.
Oh, really?
So you'd have to go to church, have communion, then you could come home and have breakfast. So, you know, at that time, you know, you didn't have masses that went on, you know, at 9 p.m. because, you know, people wouldn't have been waiting that long. But,
yeah. You
know, and you didn't have 5 p.m. the night before either. It was only morning mass. Mm-hmm. So I remember those kinds of rules, you know, that related to church and faith and so on, but always rules that were broken, you know, like if you ate meat on Friday it was a mortal sin, you had to go and you know, confess. If you looked in a church that wasn't Catholic, it was a mortal sin, you had to go and confess. And you know, it's scary as a child to have all of that hanging over your head, because I don't remember hearing a lot about love and God and all of that. I just remember at church and at school, mm-hmm. hearing about, you know, the retribution. And again, mm-hmm. like with Darby and Gill and the little people, it may be that that's
why
the little part, and that's why it stuck, because it was scary to me.
Yeah.
Wasn't what I heard in other aspects, but that was the faith. So I'm thinking that with my mom, she grew up in Ireland with probably even more rigid mm-hmm. teachings.
Mm-hmm.
And then came to Canada and, you know, was at St. Ignatius Church, which was, you know, a good community of people, but still had the same kind of teaching. So I just wonder if that maybe was more woven into the fabric of her life mm-hmm. because of her upbringing as well.
Yeah.
And I still am involved with church and I do things, but I've had times when I'm not there and, I'm not worried about it. I'm not thinking... I'm more into the, you know, God loves you kind of thing. So it's changed a lot, I think, in my generation.
I find this moment really interesting. She consistently brings the conversation back to her mother, most likely because she's trying to answer my question about faith and heritage. But I think it also created the opportunity for her to speak fairly openly about the development of her personal beliefs from childhood to adulthood. I suspect if I hadn't asked anything about faith, Katrina most likely wouldn't have shared these memories. It's not something we really think to discuss with most people outside of a very particular context, such as an intimate conversation between friends or a Bible study, for example. These kinds of stories seem to require an invitation, a demonstration of some sort that shows this emotional community welcomes discussions about faith and personal beliefs. After listening to this interview again, I wonder how the answer might have been different if I had opened the door completely and simply asked Katrina about her faith. As we look at the ways in which stories are co-created both by the people I interviewed and myself, we can begin to see an outline of the boundaries of different emotional communities. Certain kinds of experiences are not commonly shared with others because social codes have deemed them private, belonging to very particular settings. There is nothing inherently bad about this, but when we embrace our role as co-creator in the interview, we can open up opportunities for interviewees to share these experiences. Through this, we create the chance to hear stories that people may be more than willing to share once they have been given the invitation.